Hello, I'm Soumi Aryan. I'm the founder of the think tank for women in business and technology and the FemPeak platform with the mission of raising women's socioeconomic status. For too long, there's been a lack of female perspective in the top tier of business, technology, philosophy, and science. We are now at a pivotal moment in our evolution as humans merge with technology, and women must have a seat at the table where the future of humanity is decided. In today's episode, you will hear me interview Dr. Sophie Bartzisch, who was a panelist on our first conference for the Think Tank for Women in Business and Technology. Sophie is a successful plastic surgeon in New York City. She tells the story of how she was discouraged from getting into this field and all the challenges of building her own medical practice. Both Sophie and I hope that this conversation will encourage more women to stand for what they believe in. So without further ado, let's dive right into the conversation with Dr. Sophie Bartzisch.
For me, the most fascinating part is your journey as a female surgeon. So tell me more about that, how you started, what were the challenges that you faced?
So, well, you know, starting from the beginning, I kind of took a little circuitous path to medicine to begin with. So I was in a European school system in New York. I was in the French school, the lycée, which was fantastic. And the interesting thing was it was its own little universe within New York then, and it was a very different approach because in the European system, you don't have general undergrad. So when you're in high school, you already have to know what you're going to do, and then you go to that vocational school. So as a young kid, they start to try to figure out who you're going to be very early, and they said, oh, you're good at math and biology, you're a doctor. And that resonated because I had so many doctors in my family, but all of the physicians in my family were men on both sides of my family. And my generation was the first one. I had a cousin who was thinking about going to medical school, but there hadn't been any women. And even though I was in New York in my household, my father was from East Germany and from a very traditional household. And my mother was from Algeria and from a very traditional household. So these were still sort of norm-breaking kinds of concepts. And then I always wondered if my parents, you know, missed out on having the son who should have been the surgeon. So I guess that's what was left. There was me. So here we are. And so, you know, they directed me into that path pretty early. And then when I went to college and saw all the options of things I could learn, I kind of rebelled against that and said, no, I want to learn other things too. I want to find out who I actually am. And I started doing psychology and art classes. And next thing you know, I'm in Parsons for grad school. I'm working in the fashion district and I'm doing all these other creative things. And it really sort of fed my soul and taught me about who I was, which was a very necessary thing. And then when that was sort of said and done, I realized, wait a minute, I think I am a doctor. So I had to come back and do that after the fact. So the first challenge was trying to get into a very good medical school, even though I hadn't done my pre-med classes. I had to go back to school for that, to Columbia. And then I did end up getting into medicine. And then the next challenge was, you know, when you're a surgeon, which is what I wanted to do, I knew I had to work with my hands. You don't have time to paint on the side and you don't have time to do something really creative in your free time. You don't have free time. So when that challenge came up, I was very fortunate. I had a mentor who sort of suggested plastic surgery, which solved that problem for me. But then that was its own problem as well, because getting into plastic surgery training was so incredibly challenging. And I had a lot of naysayers along the way. Which has always been the case in my life and doesn't stop now. And I'm okay with it. I just kind of plow through. But I do remember there was a dean of my medical school, and it was really horrifying for me afterwards to find out why this happened. You're going to find this very interesting. So I went to my meeting with her and she said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a plastic surgeon. And she said, okay, but what are you going to apply for? I said, I'm going to apply for plastic surgery. And she said, no, but you have to apply for general surgery too. And I said, why? And she said, because it's a lot easier to get into. And I said, yeah, but that's not what I want to do. And she said, I know, but you have to do that. I said, I don't have to do that. Like, why would I apply and take a spot from someone who might really want to be a general surgeon, plus put myself through all that time and expense interviewing? That's not what I want to do. And she spent 15 minutes trying to explain to me that my goals were too lofty. I wasn't going to get there. that I was probably going to end up having to do research because I'm not going to get a residency spot. She was incredibly discouraging, and I thought I was supposed to be there so she could tell me how to get to my goal and not try to talk me out of it. And finally, she got frustrated because I said, listen, I'm applying to plastics. She says, you shouldn't tell anyone. The general surgeons aren't going to take you seriously, and then you won't get the backup spot. And I said, I want a backup spot. And I finally just got frustrated and said, listen, I don't think I belong in this meeting. I'm going to go do my applications and we'll see where it lands. And I found out after the fact that the way that the medical school does its rankings is based on whether the students get the spot that they wanted. It's not about whether they get the best spot. So if they can make you aim a little lower and you can get there, it makes them look good. And that was horrifying to me because she was playing with my destiny and goals and ambitions. And when I graduated at the graduation, I remember she didn't even come to shake my hand. And it was, you know, things like that along the way that, you know, you just kind of put a notch in your mind and say, I'll never forget that. And you keep going.
That's crazy.
So that was sort of how it started. But I got in, obviously, and here I am. So she was wrong.
That's crazy because, you know, like I've got many stories like that. But do you think that the fact that you were female had something to do with her encouraging you to aim lower?
I'm sure.
It has happened to me a lot. Like people think that because you're a woman, you have to like aim a bit lower.
I'm sure. I've felt a lot of things as a woman along the way. And, you know, sometimes I tell people and they're just like, really? I mean, and even when I was a resident, so almost all of the nurses are women in the hospital and all the support staff. And I remember I had a patient who really needed something and I had asked the nurse to get it for them. And it really was urgent. And there was another resident who had a different patient and he was about 6'3" and an ex-football star from the South. And I remember I'm like, I went back to check with her, see if this was done. It was something important. And I wanted to see if it was done. And she was like, yeah, I haven't had time. But then I found out later that she went above and beyond to do something totally non-urgent for his patient and just kind of go back and tell him, by the way, I just went ahead and did this and that for you. Things like that happen constantly. Or even now, you know, sometimes, well, now that I have the gray hair, it doesn't happen as much, but I mean, I've had it happen multiple times where I perform a surgery, maybe in a hospital where I'm not there that often and not everybody there knows me. And then I come into the recovery room to check the patient afterwards. And I have an ID on me. Now I'm a plastic surgeon. We don't walk around with a stethoscope, but I have an ID on me. And I walk into the recovery room and I come up to the patient and I see the nurse and I say, oh, you know, how's she doing? And they look at me and they say, no visitors. And I say, I'm not a visitor. And then they say, are you the social worker? And I say, I'm her surgical attending. And I'm just checking if you need anything on the orders so I can tell you what I need for my patient. This is like still, unless it's a place where they really know me, which thankfully is more of the places that I'm at. But every once in a while, and they're just kind of, and I'm like, I'm the surgeon. And I just I don't understand.
Yeah, it's incredible to me that this is happening in the West. You know, I grew up in Tehran, very different. But you know, I've seen so many examples of that here. I mean, I remember with my ex, when I explained to his friends, when they asked where we met, and I said we met at a, you know, at the Ivy. They thought that I was, I must have been a waitress there or something, you know, like they wouldn't think that I was there, you know,
as a client, as a patron.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Like as a
peer person,
you know, yeah exactly. So this type of thing happens, it still happens, you know, whether it's as an investor, whether it's as an entrepreneur, whatever. So it happens also. So another thing that you talked about in backstage area that I thought it was a fascinating topic, and I really would like to, I wish people would have heard what you said about the wife thing.
When I was a resident, I remember I used to go, we had a rotation. We had a couple months where we could spend time in other plastic surgeons' offices and, you know, assist them, but also just sort of watch how they run their practice and learn about how that works. Because it is also the other most unbelievable thing is you do all of this work for medical school and nobody teaches you how to run a business on any level, not even your actual business of the practice of medicine. And then you just get thrown out there and it's so nuanced and there's so much legal stuff. And then there's, you know, people's welfare and their health information and you're not taught anything. So in our program, we thought we were really progressive because we actually had a rotation where you could go spend time with the private surgeons in their private offices and try to absorb some of that information, or at least just start to learn how things work. So you have half a chance of knowing what to do when you get there. And so I remember I spent some time in several offices in particular, and I remember each and every one of them, the office manager was their wife. The surgeon had his wife. She may have had a prior career. If she did, it had been abandoned. She may have been just a homemaker, which is, one could argue, an even more difficult job. So let's not even go there. But whatever it was, she was now managing the office. And she was in charge of hiring and firing. She was also cleaning up. She was also making sure it was presentable. The patients who had any issues, she could just go right in. She didn't have a time schedule. She worked 24/7. Right? You didn't have to worry about that. There was no overtime. There was no not showing up. She made sure no one stole anything. She made sure everything, all the bills came in. This was all, you know, who could you trust more? It's sort of like if you have, you know, grandma watching the child, there's no one you could trust more. So when you have your wife watching your business, there's no one you can trust more, right? Mm-hmm. So they all had this person who was taking care of their house, taking care of the children, monitoring their practice and keeping everything tight. And all the guy had to do was operate. It was unbelievable. And I'm watching this and I'm like, that's unbelievable. Then I went to a conference in Texas, this big conference, and the guy who was in charge of the conference, very well-known plastic surgeon. He does so many things for all of plastic surgery. And I remember thinking, like, how can he possibly be the editor of a journal, the head of the conference, run a practice, have 15 fellows who train under him every 5 minutes? And he comes up and he gives a whole talk. And then somehow it slipped out that the woman standing in the back of the room, who also was basically organizing the entire conference, was his wife. And she's doing everything too. And I got very upset. And I went home and I looked at my husband and I said, where's my wife? And he said, what? I said, I've been going around for years and I'm looking at all these people and I'm supposed to do and achieve what they do and achieve. But I want to know how I can do that without a wife. And he just, poor guy, just looked at me, he's like, I don't know what to tell you. And I said, well, just be warned, I might get one. And that's it. So, because they seem incredibly useful and they really make the difference a lot of the time.
They do.
And so that's my whole thing is, you know, I'm walking around and I am also the wife, which I am delighted to do. And it totally fulfills me in certain ways. But yeah, it's always going to be an extra effort because I don't have one.
So you know, they say that behind every successful man is a supportive woman. That's so true. And it always reminds me of that there was a quote in Big Fat Greek Wedding. I don't know if you've seen
the
it.
The head and the neck. I remember it.
I know. It's like, like the man is the head, right? But the woman is the neck. So without the neck.
Turn the head.
it's absolutely true. I was thinking about all the really successful men that have impacted me in business, in philosophy, you know, technology, everything. They have a supportive woman behind them, you know, like Ray Dalio, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk. They all have somebody that's like taking care of a huge part of the family life and running everything smoothly. And then in many cases, the person is also helping them with their business, with the management of the business and all that stuff.
It happens all the time.
The takeaway lesson, I made a note here, by the way, that I think when going back to the platform, one of the areas that we should work on is to teach women, whether they're researchers, surgeons, you know, doctors, to teach them basic principles of running a business, because actually they don't get that anywhere else. So speaking of that, tell me about that journey, running your own practice.
That's a really interesting question. And I think that depends on who you ask, and especially now that's really evolving. So typically and traditionally, the options were you either went out and they used to call it you hang a shingle and you just see who shows up. So you kind of take out a loan, you get an office space, and you just kind of sit there and say, I'm here, and you see if anyone comes over. The other option would be to get a job. And the jobs can be either to go work with someone who is already in their own office, and then they kind of take you in. They tend to make that to their advantage as much as they can. And I've seen not that many of those situations work out. Or you get a job in a hospital. And you get a job in a hospital, there are certain things that you have to do. They own you completely. And you just kind of show up, you do your work, you get an admin, you get an office. You don't have to do any of the billing. You don't have to understand most of these things. You sort of come into your work, give your paperwork in, and make sure you take your call and fulfill your responsibilities and do your conferences, do some teaching. So there are people who favor the academic route because it just sort of streamlines it and it's easier. There are some people who do it because they feel academic and they want to be somewhere where all the novelty and the research is happening. They'd have access to a lab and they can try and discover things. They have teams of residents and medical students, so they're not just sort of hanging out there doing everything on their own. And they don't have to deal with all of the business stuff, which in medicine is just mind numbing and only gets more complicated and more difficult and more defeating as you go. So it's always been sort of that dichotomy. Now we have an interesting thing that's happening in medicine because a lot of people who were on their own, because of how incredibly bureaucratic, administrative, how the social media has kind of destroyed us, and financially, physicians are having a really hard time getting by because the idea of doctors as rich is stuck to something that was 50 years ago and does not exist anymore. And that's also very defeating. So there are a lot of people who've been on their own who are now either selling their practices and becoming an employee or going back to the hospitals and just working on like a punch card kind of way. We're losing actively and immediately, we're losing a lot of the incredible talent in medicine for a lot of different reasons. So, but when you get started, usually that's kind of it. Do I try to join someone? Do I go on my own, which now is very difficult, almost impossible, or do I take a job somewhere? And those are sort of your paths.
You said that social media has destroyed. How's that happened?
And I'm probably not allowed to say that as a plastic surgeon.
But that's fascinating because you would think, like, from what I see, everybody looks like they've done something to themselves. Yeah. On social media. So they must be going to plastic surgeons, right?
A lot of people are. I guess, you know, I have kind of an old school vision of medicine, and maybe it's because of where I come from and my family and my father. And, you know, my approach to medicine is it should be very personal. My approach to medicine is it should be sort of an old school clinician kind of thing. Like, you shouldn't be treating the CAT scan, you should be treating the patient. These are all the things that I kind of have in my bones. And so, you know, I believe in spending time with your patient. I believe in really talking to them, being available to them, understanding them, having some intuition, being able to diagnose things. Those are the things that I think make you a good physician. And in terms of, you know, so in terms of just having the reputation and surviving and getting referrals, you know, in my mind, it should be based on the quality of your work and what kind of care you delivered to people. And that used to be the case, right? Before we had these platforms, the only way that somebody would refer to you is if they had already known that you took care of someone, did a good job, or somebody sent you a relative. And that's how you got patients. And then you just became known as someone who delivered good care. That's exactly how my father's practice was for 40 plus years. And I feel like now that we're in this marketing move, it's been largely replaced by who can market themselves better. And I don't think that's only in medicine. When you go onto Amazon, everybody buys the same Halloween costume because it's the first one that they found when they searched. And then because everyone bought it, it stays the first one and it just kind of feeds itself. There might be a really awesome one on page 32. You're never going to get them, you know? So yeah. You're going to see whatever is sort of in your face. And I feel like in medicine, this has sort of taken on a life that I think is almost a little bit inappropriate, because there are people who are incredibly well marketed, have huge budgets for it, know how to work the whole platform. And I can tell you as an insider that those are not necessarily, for a lot of them, the physicians that I would go to or send my family to. The ones that I would no one's ever heard of them. So, but I know that when I need that person, they're going to answer the phone. I know they're going to take it seriously, do a good job. I've seen their work. So I guess, you know, for me, it's a little bit of a frustration, because I would hope that medicine would still be based on quality of care and not marketing. And I feel like that blurs lines a lot. Mm-hmm. And I also feel like there's, in the same way, a little bit of a loss of privacy, mm-hmm. that I think is also a little bit of an issue. So we talk so much about preserving patients' privacy and their health information, but plastic surgery especially, it's just out there. And you know, the fact that there's 50,000 videos that take place inside the operating room, that always makes me feel a little bit strange. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, should everyone really be watching surgery? I don't know.
I mean, you're talking to somebody who runs a marketing agency, you know, that's like, yeah. I make my money from our marketing agency, and then I invest that money into things like building the think tank, the platform, things like that. Our job is to help surgeons like yourself tell their story. But you are right. Ultimately, doesn't matter how good of a surgeon you are, if you are not the one who's paying us to market you, yeah. then right. somebody else is, right? For example, one of our clients is Steinway Pianos, obviously it's like the best pianos in the world. Yeah. One thing I've learned is that, unfortunately, this is the truth, that you have to put away your opinion. I know that it's hard, but the truth is that your opinion is not going to change it. Do you see what I mean?
Of course not.
And that's the problem, because it's like, if we start thinking about, my opinion is that surgeons shouldn't have to market themselves. My opinion is that, you know, the camera shouldn't be in the surgery room. Unfortunately, you know, or some people would say fortunately, but unfortunately, from your point of view, especially, that era is finished.
It's done, and
it doesn't mean that I like it. It doesn't mean that many people like it, but it has gone. And that's the nature of evolution. So especially as a female surgeon, that's why it's important for you to be on the panel of conferences and be doing this kind of thing. This is marketing in a way, you know, because it gets you in front of a lot of people. Yes, you're sharing your journey, your story, and that's important. Whether we like it or not, we live in this world now. I wrote this book called Career Fear and How to Beat It, which came out a few weeks ago. And in that book, there's a whole section on the nature of the digital economy. You know, I'm trying to explain that, like exactly what you said, the digital economy is essentially a winner-take-all economy. It's tough, you know. I've been doing a lot of interviews, podcasts myself about this topic, and it feels like sometimes some people get upset when I say these things. All I'm saying is that this is the truth. This is happening. It's probably even more important than ever that you do market yourself.
To speak to your point, this is the way it is, and there's nothing anyone's going to do to change it. And my personal interest in being part of it is very measured and very targeted. So I don't ever plan on being the wet t-shirt contest plastic surgeon on Instagram. That's not going to happen. But I think, to your point, understanding that it's a reality, then you got to figure out where is your place in it. So I don't think I'm ever going to be the one that has the most posts. I don't have time for that. I'm actually taking care of my patients. But I think it's important for someone like me to have some presence.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it just gets invaded by everything else that's just the marketing machine. And I feel, I'd like to think that having someone like me there, to some degree, even if I'm not going to be the most present, to have some presence kind of keeps things classy. You know what I mean?
Is the key here, because you want to do it in a dignified way.
Well, that is exactly right. And I think my hesitations with it have to do with the way it's done, which, like you said, is just my opinions and feelings and have nothing to do with whether or not it's going to be shut down. It's not going to be shut down. But then I have an opportunity to distinguish myself as someone who's doing it a little differently, as someone who's preserving, you know, some dignity exactly to my patients and to myself. I take my profession very seriously. I don't see it as a street fair. I see it as a surgical practice, and I see it as a vehicle to improve people's lives. And my patients are me. My patients are women in their 30s, 40s, 50s. I identify with them as well. And there's a certain level of understanding and respect and propriety that I really maintain. And I think having things like that are in there you know, the whole scene is a little peppered by some of this too, is important to keep it grounded. So I actually, even though I'm not very present in social media, I see my existence there as important to keep things a little bit grounded. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's necessary. So my vision of things is, if you see something and you don't think it's great, then get in there and do some great things within it. And at least you're part of what's making it stay good. You know what I mean? So that's sort of my approach. So, but that's sort of my vision of where my place is in terms of how I get my patients. So, you know, it's always interesting. Once they've met me, it's a whole other situation. We have a relationship. I get my patients from existing patients, and who send me their relatives and their friends. I get my patients from other doctors who are colleagues of mine who send me a patient and then hear about the experience and then just keep sending me patients. And I do get some patients from being online because I do have an online presence. I've worked very hard to try to present on my website what my philosophies are, what my goals are, my focuses, what things I'm trying to offer and do for people. I think it does come across. And it's interesting because the patients who come to me in a very targeted way. Yes. They come in and they say, I read something that you wrote, or I saw something that you did and it resonated and I wanted to come to you. I don't tend to have a huge amount of people who are just looking for a plastic surgeon, shopping around, where can I get this thing done at the cheapest price or, you know, quickest time. I tend to get very targeted people who heard what I said and then want to be in this space with me. So, and that's what I want. So it's, it, you know, people, you attract what you need and people find you and they just gravitate to you. And, you know, fortunately I can say I get lucky a lot and I have a lot of amazingly intuitive, educated, sophisticated, smart patients. And, you know, it's just, my practice is fantastic, but a lot of it is self-generating or very, very targeted. And that's sort of how my little universe works.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things that we do is work with thought leaders. But what would be fascinating is if you could give some advice to young women who are maybe thinking about a career as a plastic surgeon or in medicine in general.
So, well, let's assume that you're already in med school and you've gone through that initial initial issue. So, you know, the plastic surgery world has evolved also, and it used to be that people would go into general surgery first for however many years and then try to get into plastic surgery. And that's changed. Now you get in straight from medical school. So the first thing is you have to figure that out early on. The second thing is find a mentor because you're going to have a lot of trouble doing anything if you don't have an existing plastic surgeon who can literally guide you through and give you advice along the way. In terms of becoming a plastic surgeon, you have to get into a residency training program. And you are unlikely to get into a program unless they already know you. People will always go with what they know. So you have to take every opportunity in medical school to do a rotation wherever it is you really want to go. If you can get there and spend a little time there and get those and make an impression on those people, even if there's a candidate whose numbers are better, you become a known entity. And if they know that you are going to value the spot that you were given and that you are going to work really hard and take care of their patients really well, they will give you a thought. So it's really a matter of being around the things you want to do. Don't trust your papers to do it for you. You have to get to know the people. You have to show the interest. And to that point, know you really want to do it. So there are a lot of things that people do because they like the idea of it, or they have a vision of what it might be like when they become that person. Surgery and medicine in general is not that thing that you just try.
I'm sure that's one of the biggest, and
you know, that it sounds like, of course not, but no, really, there are a lot of things that you can try in terms of careers. And if it doesn't really work out or you realize it wasn't for you, that's okay. You can do something else. There are a lot of people who switch out of medicine, but it's a very life-altering kind of thing to get in and to get out. Mm-hmm. And along the way, it's like going to war. I mean, surgical training is like going to war. So you have to really want it. they're going, you have to want it so much that even in the moments where you want to flush your pager down the toilet, and I remember the moment when I almost did, like, you actually look at the toilet and you look at your pager and you say, no, because I want it that bad. You have to feel that way about it. And even when you're in practice at my stage, there are days where you want to flush your phone down the toilet and you don't, because it has to be a passion. It can't be a profession. It has to be a passion. Yes. You have to, you know, get the phone call at 2 a.m. because there's something or you're on call or whatever it is, and you have to get up and, you know, it's 2 a.m. But this is what you do for the pleasure and privilege of being in the operating room, because when you walk into the OR and you put on your gloves, you feel a way that nothing else in your life can make you feel. And you have to feel that way about it. And if you do, it's all good. So
that's amazing. That actually gave me goosebumps, because, you know, it's how I feel about my work. And I really think if you have that passion, something if that makes you want to wake up in the morning, get up, you know, yes, in the morning and do it with passion, you know, that's, that feeling is amazing.
To your point, it is the greatest gift in the world to really like what you get up and do every day for a living.
Yes.
And not a lot of people have that feeling.
No. Like, I honestly, every morning I'm like, I'm so grateful. I love my life, you know.
I can tell.
And so the business part of it is fascinating, because I think, you know, you could take a course on running a business.
There are no courses on running a medical business. If you go to, and if you go get an MBA, or you speak to anyone who's gotten an MBA, any of the big business schools, I defy you to find a single class that teaches you about medical
business. Yeah, medical business. Yeah.
Like having a medical practice.
That's fascinating.
And then there's the second part of it, which is the actual business of medicine and businesses within medicine. So these are all different things. So there's, I run my practice. How do I just run my practice? Meaning, what kinds of insurances do I need? And what kinds of employees do I need? And what do I need to know about the laws? What kind of attorney do I need? Mm-hmm. That's a very tricky thing too, because in law, there's no specialization within law school for medical law, even though medical law is about as complicated as it gets. Mm-hmm. So when you're trying to find a medical attorney, you actually have to ask doctors who are the attorneys who specialize in healthcare, because they didn't specialize like you specialize in patent law, where there's a different actual legal training that's formal and a certain certification. They don't even acknowledge that in law school. It just happens to be certain attorneys end up working with doctors early in their career, decide that they like healthcare, also realize there's so few attorneys who specialize in healthcare, even though there's so much healthcare law needed for these poor doctors. Wow. And so you end up having to just seek them out. You can't look it up like, who are patent firms? It doesn't work that way. So you can't even find the right lawyers, and you don't even know. No one tells you, you need a lawyer who's a healthcare lawyer. And then if you find out you do, you don't even know where to find them. So there's the medical, running your own medical practice thing. And then there's the other part, which is the businesses that can come out of medicine. So let's say I'm a surgeon and I want to develop an instrument for the operating room. Where do I start?
Yes.
Who do I talk to? I'm standing there and I'm holding something. I go, you know, if they just made this like that, it would be so much better. Okay, great. Go do it. How? I have no idea. Yes. When you're in business school, if they tell you, if you come up with a device, right, this is what you do. This is how you find out. This is how you protect it with a patent. This is how you get to the right people. This is what kind of partners you might need. They kind of walk you through if you wanted to come up with an idea. You're in medicine. You're sitting there. You're like, this light really isn't good, or this knife is bent the wrong way. You have no idea where to start. And then if you try to start, everyone around you is like, yeah, good luck with that.
Fascinating. Okay? Yes.
So there's the two parts. There's the medical practice itself. And then, God forbid, you want to start a business as a physician.
So many of these industries are so out of date. And I really hope to encourage and inspire women to see those opportunities.
That's a very good point. And that's where women are at a disadvantage. And I'll tell you exactly how. So men go to college, right? And all of their fraternity brothers do different things, especially in you know, Ivy League schools and things. Most of their friends and the guys who live in the house with them are going to not go into medicine. They're going to go into business or law or whatever it is. they retain a lot of those relationships. Those boys or young men become older men who have among them a much better chance of having been promoted to some kind of seniority, some leadership. And also, they're bound to have a handful of them who are in a position where they're controlling large amounts of money. Mm-hmm. The women are less likely, fast forward 20 years, to have a whole bunch of very good friends they've known for 20 years who have control of either political people, decision makers, leaders of companies, or God forbid, financial managers or people who have control of money. So let's say there's that guy who's in medical school and now he becomes a surgeon and he wants to invent something. He has a bunch of very good friends who are not doctors, who can open all kinds of doors and probably even write a check. Mm-hmm. And that happens. And the women, number one, very few women are even asked, do you want to invent something? Do you want to create something? Do you want to go beyond just your practice and build something? It doesn't even occur to us. We're just happy that we're even in the hospital because that was already an achievement, right? So, but you know, wait a minute, run the hospital. Wait a minute, invent something, cure something. That's unusual. Now there are a lot of women today. There's more women in medical school than men, which is a separate thing, but it's not because they're the leaders of industry. That's a separate issue, which we can get into later. But we are not spoken to about, well, why don't you make something more of it? Mm-hmm. The men are spoken to about that. And then the minute they get out of the medical bubble and they're around their other friends who are in other industries, it's always, well, how do you do something significant with that? How do you build something with that? How do you start up something? You know, no one's ever looked at me and said, what's your startup going to be? What's your legacy going to be? Like, what are you going to do that's going to really make a difference? No, I had to just decide on my own that I want to do that and try and figure it out. But I think that the conversation around men and women is very different. And the doors are more, the conversation starts around men more, and then they have more resources. Even if you go all the way back to the little boys they played with when they were little, the guys they were in college with, they just have more access because those things that you need to make these things happen are largely controlled by men. Yes. That's just how it is. And so we don't really have those same resources for the most part. So if you sit there and you come up with something, you know, you're not going to call Mike from, you know, from junior year and be like, Mike, I have this amazing idea. Can you get your company to write me a check for $10 million?
Yeah.
Mike's not going to take your call. You know, Mike was dating your friend and he's mad at her. He's not the guy that you've known for 25 years. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. It's just, so it's the dynamics, you know, go that deep. Yes. In terms of having access.
But I'm going to play devil's advocate here because I do agree with you and I can see completely where you're coming from. But I really think in the absence of opportunity, what can we do to change that? So I come from Iran. I came to the UK in 2005. I didn't know anybody here. I came here alone without my family. I have no family in the UK. I'm like literally like one person in this country, right? So I came with a suitcase as a student, paid my fees as an overseas student, which was quite a lot, three times what, you know, normal students would pay. Had no connection whatsoever, but I completely changed that. You need to be resourceful. You know, this was always my motto, was like, if they don't let me into their circle, I'll create my own circle. I got to a point that I remember before COVID and everything, I used to do these breakfast meetings at a club at the Ivy in London. I had like, say, 12 people for the breakfast, and we had really high profile people come to the breakfast, the CEO of really large companies, or the MDs of the companies, from say HSBC to Jimmy Choo, you know, like such a variety. Yeah. And I was like, okay, I only came to the UK 15 years ago. And look where I am now, you know, 14 years ago. These people are coming to my breakfast to learn from me, because I've done something. I created a documentary that explained about millennials, technology, and how technology is changing business. Actually, you know, for example, Justine Salfo, mm-hmm. who was on the panel, actually, that's how we met. She came to my breakfast meeting, and then we became really good friends. And then she has now invested in one of the companies that I invested in. And actually also Leah as well, Dr. Leah Austin, who was also on the panel. So that goes to show, like, it, okay, yes, we don't have those deep relationships with people who are going to do that, but we need to become resourceful now
first
and change that. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to create the Femtalent platform, because I really think women
supporting themselves and creating deep relationships is so important.
I think there's two parts of that. I think there's the barrier breaking and I think there's the relationship building, and those are two different things.
Exactly.
So if there aren't that many women somewhere, it doesn't mean that my acknowledgement that there aren't that many doesn't mean that we don't belong there. It's just my acknowledgement that there aren't that many. But make no mistake about it, I'll knock on a door till it opens. Like, I'm not asking.
we're going to do something.
That's it. And, you know, the goal is to just worm your way in until I don't care if there's not many, you belong there.
Yeah.
But the second part is, yes, I think that if we, you know, women are so resourceful, determined, incredibly adaptable, incredibly passionate. One of the things I have found is that there are fewer women who really get into some enormous business, you know, endeavor. But when they do, it's really with their hearts for the most part. Like, women just, they for them, it's like a passion project. They do it because they just can't help it. They have to make this happen. And I think there's a certain amount of fire and devotion, for lack of a better word, to what they're trying to build, that, you know, women approach everything a little differently than men. And it's not a question of better or worse. But I think there's so much to when a woman decides to make something happen and really just put blood, sweat, and tears into it. And by the same token, I think that there's a lot when women invest in other projects, whether they're women's projects or men's. There's a different kind of attitude towards what am I going to really put myself into? And I think a lot of times when women invest in another person's project, they really want to see it succeed, and they're nurturing it like a plant that's growing. It's not just I'm putting money in like a stock and I hope it comes back. So I also enjoy very much that relationship with the way that women invest in anything, and especially each other, and the way that women build their own businesses and the things that they want to do as like important projects. I think there's something special about it that has not been harnessed at all yet.
Yes.
Like, it's just not, we haven't figured out how to make that happen. So, you know, my acknowledging that these are things that are harder for a lot of women than for men doesn't mean we shouldn't do it or it's never going to happen. It's just that, yeah, it is harder because the way things work in the networks we have now definitely favors these longstanding relationships that men have with each other for the most part. And we haven't yet figured out how to make the women have those relationships with each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's super important. And you can't let go. You have to keep going. And, you know, whether it's because I'm a woman or whether because I'm a surgeon and not a formal researcher, or whether it's because I don't have an MBA and I'm not a business guy, I've spent my whole life being told you're not the type that you'd expect for the thing you're trying to do. I don't really care.
So hopefully the next step from here would be people will hear your podcast, your interview, and they will get a real sense of the challenges that you're facing and we are facing as women. And nobody else is going to solve those problems. We need to do it ourselves.
No.
So it's been absolutely eye-opening, thought-provoking talking to you. And I hope that women out there, people out there are going to listen and think about both, see the opportunities to make a real change, and to also see the business opportunity as well, you know, to improve lives and to create new business opportunities for. And I really hope we can encourage women to be the ones that will grab those, especially when it comes to solving problems for women.
Thank you so much. This has been great. I do want to leave with two thoughts. One, that someone called me for an interview. And they said, you know, the first question she said is, what do you want your legacy to be? And I thought, isn't that wonderful? That's the nicest question anyone's ever asked me. No one's ever asked me that, because I don't think we think of it that way. So I encourage all women to think like a man, but in a woman way, and consider the fact that you have a legacy just as well. And it's up to you to decide what that's going to be, and you should make the most of it. And the second thing I just want to say is, you know, we're celebrating women for sure. Well, let's not forget about the really great guys who are out there. And, you know, for every strong man, there's a really strong woman behind him. But for every woman who succeeds, there was at least one man who saw the promise and went out of his way and supported her from within. And I definitely want to give a shout out to the guys who, both my partners in business and the people in my personal and professional life who supported this, because that is one of the best ways to break barriers, is to break barriers as the other, but use the local people for help and recruit them. Let them help you. Yeah. Thank you so
awesome.
Much.
Awesome. Thank you.
This has been great.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. Sophie Bartish. We often hear that there are not enough female role models. I would argue that there are, but history has failed to highlight them. That's why they call it history and not her story. So I want to end each episode of this podcast by giving a shout out to women who have made a difference and deserve to be celebrated. I dedicate today's podcast to a female physicist called Qianxuan Wu, who worked on the Manhattan Project and made a significant contribution in the field of nuclear physics. She's also known for the Wu experiment, which overturned the theory of parity in physics. Her work led to a Nobel Prize that was awarded to her male colleagues. Here's to a future generation of women whose story will not be forgotten. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe on iTunes or Spotify and YouTube, or connect with me on LinkedIn, Twitter, or Instagram.